Okay, so just to catch everyone up. So last week, those who were here might remember we had movie time. We had a viewing. So we had, YouTube showing to be specific. And we used a fascinating, not frontal lecture so much as a public conversation between Professor Sandel and his students in the Harvard YouTube recording. Around questions of ethics. And what we suggested as we watched it together is that questions such as the trolley car ethics question case, the classic case of do you kill five or do you kill one, or questions of priorities in medical triage, transplant questions, etc., which he humorously portrayed, essentially open up overarching philosophical questions or ethical questions that are going to have tremendous ramifications and for our purposes, not just questions of triage, but issues such as DNR and DNI and priorities and patient autonomy and the role of the family and withdrawing care, withholding care. All of these questions are contingent on or an outgrowth of larger overarching questions that really apply across the field in ethics. We said last week that self-driving cars are subject to similar ethical questions about pre-programming the cars to killing one person in order to kill multiple people, right, or vice versa, to avert killing multiple people in order to kill just one, for example. These kinds of scenarios are brave new world. They're with us all the time, as we noted last week. And we also said and began to discuss and explore together the question of the value of life. Is life of what significance is life? And I actually wanted to open up, we saw last time two relevant sources about this topic, but I wanted to kind of reopen that question, kind of discuss it a little bit together, and to pose the question to us as a group. Do we think that in Judaism, life is the highest value? And feel free to share your own wisdom. We can look at some sources. Is that a thumbs up? Is that a thumb? What's your reaction when you hear that statement? Agree or disagree? Anyone?
Agree with the caveat that there are some exceptions. You're not allowed to blaspheme God in public. You're not allowed to do certain sexual acts. And I forget the third.
Right, idolatry.
Idolatry.
Well, that's the first category. That's relations and murder.
So one would say. I might say that that not desecrating God is the highest value, but under that comes valuing life to the extreme, because to the degree that we are all created in Tzelem Elokim, I think that's the foundation of our ethics. You can't do something bad to other people, because that is a desecration of God and inherent dignity and all that stuff. So that's
good. So it's incredibly high.
But within the philosophic, I think I mentioned this last week, that you know, because there is a death penalty. So when you are permitted to stone someone to death, it's not always to preserve life. It's not always to avoid desecration or idolatry. And you know, I wish I could. I don't have the knowledge to categorize all of the acts that require it. It was interesting because the attorney general, district attorney's race in Philadelphia, pitted a fellow with limited experience and prosecution experience. But he came, you know, like one of his big things, in addition to reducing incarceration, was no death penalty. And I thought, wait a minute, I don't believe in no death penalty. It's, you know, there are times. And I thought, I wonder how many people, I mean, I wonder, you know, if that's become, you know, a value that's rising in our society.
Interesting.
Just to follow up on what Louis just said, I believe in the death penalty, and I don't believe in the death penalty in the following sense. Theoretically, I do, social contract and all that.
But there are mistakes.
Not only mistakes, but the way it's implemented, probably in our society egregiously, and
right.
I don't know about other societies, it is so unfair that it's there's so many other factors that come into play that I don't think it's justice. Unless you, like somebody, if you catch somebody red-handed, unfortunately you've just had these examples, like terrorist attacks.
If the fellow hadn't shot himself,
he would have
deserved the death penalty.
And at least on TV, I don't understand why on the Law and Order shows, which I do love many of them, because they are at least used to raise moral questions, they're so careful to avoid killing the very clear-cut killer. Kill the guy. Let him jump off the roof and save the taxpayers money because, again, the violation of the social contract. But in general, we know that our justice system is not fair and racist and all that. So therefore, I would be very hesitant to implement. And I say that because I wonder if other people are against the death penalty for that very reason.
I suspect so. And what is it, the any court that... that gives the death penalty more than once in every 70 years.
Right,
it's called the bloody court.
So
I understand. You don't do it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And
I think, I think you're right. I think it's interesting. This is underemphasized and a little bit of a side point, but I think the rabbis also were concerned that sometimes the people who are responsible, at least in a Beis Din type of system, for implementing the death penalty may be people who are inclined toward violence, right? That is, it has the potential to be a self-selecting population of people who, this is my own interpretation. I haven't heard this elaborated, but I think, so for example, the Gemara talks specifically about someone who's delivering lashes and goes overboard. You know, which shows a certain kind of sensitivity about this kind of mindset. And I wonder, and the language of the Mishnah about a Beis Din that kills too regularly is that it calls it a Beis Din of murderers, Ratzchanim. And while it's not explicit in the Mishnah, I've always wondered kind of in the back of my mind as part of what's going on over there that's a significant risk, because if you are going to naturally have a world in which people who are inclined toward physical violence find themselves in professional positions where they can act upon those urges, well, then are you setting up your system for justice? I wonder. I mean, it's terrible to think about in this context, but you have other areas. This is a very hard example and a painful one, but I think it's important to mention. We know that unfortunately, whether in the Jewish community and famously in the Catholic community and the general community, the incidents in terms of abuse, which we've talked about in the past, but the incidence of such scenarios are shockingly high, and so as a society we try to understand what's going on, and there are many things that ought to be said, and it's distressing and unacceptable no matter what. But I think part of it, and as a teacher, this is a deeply uncomfortable thing to say, but I think it's important all the more so for teachers and administrators to be honest and acknowledge this reality, that there is a self-selecting element to this, which is that there are, and I've heard this from professionals in the field, which is that there are some people, unfortunately, who are really not well mentally, and they choose to put themselves in positions where they can interact with children because they find tremendous joy, you know, in a twisted sort of way in such interactions. So this idea that it's a self-selecting population in terms of people who act on urges that maybe many people have in healthy ways or other just ones that most people don't have at all in that kind of way is something to be aware of. So I wonder if that's part of it. Anyhow, so yeah, this larger question about the value of life, to come back to that overarching question, we kind of segued into an interesting conversation about capital punishment, this question of the value of life, I think there really is a tension, because on the one hand, we say that life is of such omnisignificance, and yet there are three exceptions, and yet we wonder, well, what's the purpose of life? Right, Selam Elokim, is it of intrinsic significance, or is it more of a means to an end of serving God? Right? What's the purpose? If life is merely about existing, you know, then, you know, is that all there is? And is that really what Judaism aspires toward? And yet, if you say that all of life is only significant as a means toward the end of worshiping God, then as soon as I can't worship God, and what does that mean to worship God anyway? And sort of how do you tease those out? So the question of this tension of medical practice or saving a life and caring for others as for the sake of life as an end unto itself versus as a means to another end is, I think there's a real tension here, and it goes back to the larger tension that we were exploring last week as well, which is this question of how do we see ethics? Are they instrumental? Are they about the consequences of our behaviors, or is there sort of an inherent ethical valence or quality to our actions? And I think that that's really part of the tension here. So that's what we started last week. So I wanted to share some other sources and to hear what you thought. So sources 1 and 2 we went through. So we saw a responsum from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who was a great and humane 20th century halachic authority. And he kind of says, well, life has inestimable value. And so there really is no measurement or standard. And he says, and the proof is in the pudding, if an individual is completely mentally incapacitated, it's the same act of murder. It makes no difference whatsoever. And even if you can make the claim, whatever this means, that they can't perform Torah and mitzvot or study Torah, perform mitzvot, what does it even mean? Right? But even if we could grant that, it's the same act of murder, and we're obligated to save such a life. So obviously there's inherent value. In that context, we talked about the question, the scenario of two people in the desert and the flask of water, and the question of whom we prioritize. And again, this idea that, well, if the consequence is going to be that both are going to die, well, that's not useful, right? From a Jewish perspective, if life is of inestimable value, then yeah, even in a difficult scenario, sometimes when we have to choose, so that also plays into the conversation. So I wanted to come to the next side. I'm just going to set aside source 3 for the moment. So go to source 4. So source 4, just give you a little bit of background to this, and this is one of the pivotal responsa, or rather halakhic rulings, that then leads us toward a contemporary conceptual framework for end-of-life care. Because what I want to continue to do today is to kind of give that overarching, and to explore together that overarching conceptual framework, and then we'll be properly positioned to look at the concrete questions, the DNRs, and the transplantation, and the triage, and brain death, and all these sorts of things. So the background to the source 4, which is the Shilte Giborim, which is a late medieval commentary that appears on the comment to the Rif. If you're familiar, in the back, if you open up a page of Gemara, in the back of the Gemara you have the Rif, which is essentially a sort of a shorthand, condensed version of the practical halacha. It kind of gives you the basic halachot that appear in the passages, the relevant passages in the Gemara, and then he generally gives you a practical bottom line, a sort of a more practical-oriented posseg. The Shilte Giborim is a commentary on the Rif. But this passage, before we read it in of itself, I think it's worth just giving the background. That's the law of a goses. The law of a goses refers to an individual's in a scenario that is life-threatening.
Goses.
A goses. A goses is a Hebrew halachic term, spelled
G-O.
alternatively. Sometimes it's actually easier.
I've never seen it.
Okay, the goses. Okay, how would you know, Art Scroll would write it like this, I guess. I don't know if they put it here. All right, you get the idea, right? Goses. Gooses. Anyhow, so it's a situation of a person not just dying, but someone who's literally on one's deathbed and is within the last few, it's hard to define precisely, but last few minutes, last few days probably might be more accurate, but toward the very end, and the doctors are confident that this is indeed the end. So the halacha is, it's supposed to be in the Gemara, and it's codified in the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch, that a person in such a situation, if someone else would actively hasten the death of that individual, that's full-fledged murder. Right? Shortening one's life by even a very short period of time, that is ritzicha. That's one of the big three. It makes no difference whatsoever. The logic
regardless of merciful suffering or
yes, so the Gemara does not deal with that. Hold on, so we're going to get there, obviously. Yeah. That's not the bottom line or the last word, right? And I'm intentionally provoking everyone I know. But I'm sneaky that way, I confess. at least you pegged me. I know, I look sneaky and all that. Come off that way to everyone. So anyhow, so the Gemara doesn't say that, but to be fair, in other words, I'm accurately presenting what the Gemara says. The Gemara simply says that if you have a goses and you actively cause the individual to die earlier, then you're chayav misa. That's an act of murder. It's really all the Gemara says. Now, what does that mean? What are the ramifications? What does that mean for palliative care and so on and so forth? That those become the complex questions. But that is an important baseline in halacha. And so on the basis of that, the Shulti Giborim comes to a painful, relevant scenario. Now, what's interesting here is we see the intersection between halachic categories and contemporary medical assumptions. When I say contemporary, I don't mean 21st century. I mean his own contemporary assumptions. So you'll see. But it's interesting to read together. So here's his ruling, and tell me A, what you think, and also what's your response in terms of what this might or might not look like in a contemporary setting? What would a contemporary application of his principle look like to your mind?
But isn't this contradicting what the Gemara says about, you know, if somebody's chopping wood, and that's keeping the soul from departing, so you can stop chopping wood.
Excellent, very good. So let's read the Shulti Giborim together, and that's going to be relevant to the source 10, which is the Ramah of Moshe Isserlin. So you're a step ahead, and we're going to all try to catch up with you in just a few moments, but you're right on time. Yeah. So here's what he says, based on this law of Goses, it would appear last sword to prohibit Mashinagin Satan Hashim, that which some have the custom to do, namely Geshame Goses, when the person is on the cusp of dying. The in Hanishama Yechola, let's say, but the soul, excuse me, there's a typo, there's not able to leave. Sheshomtin Hakar Mitachtav Kadeshim Ut Mehra, they remove the pillow from beneath him so he dies quickly. Sheomrim, because they believe, he's not even endorsing this medical assumption, which is interesting. The zone, right? Ki yesh bamita not sok shelo fot shegar min la nefesh shelo teitzai. So they claim that the bed contains some feathers that cause the soul not to depart. So somehow it's stopping the soul from departing, and I'm going to allow the soul to depart by removing the pillow. But kama pamim sa'akti kechruchya velo ala biyadi. It says, on multiple occasions I protested, but it did not literally arise in my hand, meaning he was not able to change anyone's mind, to move the needle on this. And not only that, but my own teachers rejected my own view. Rabbi Cholku Alai, my rabbis, my teachers disagreed with me. Rabbi Natan actually wrote that this is permissible.
Permissible to remove the pillow that will hasten the death.
That's right. So in other words, This Shulti Giborim sees this, and he, in his own lifetime, says he gets up and he rebukes those people who are doing this. They're murderers. You can imagine that, right? This is like the brain death, right? Almost, I mean, it's not quite the extreme. Either you're killing someone or you're saving someone else's life. You don't have that, but either it's murder or it's an act that's maybe merciful, arguably, right? So maybe if they're suffering, right? Or at least it's inconsequential, relatively speaking. So the back and forth. So first, how do you understand the debate? What are they arguing over? What are the parameters here?
Well, it's the question that we've been talking about. Do you hasten death even by, you know, a few minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Who's someone who's...
But isn't... What about the law of the Goses? Meaning, the teacher, Rabbi Natan Avigra, could not deny that Gemara's ruling that it's prohibited to murder the Goses. So how would we reconcile that view?
Well, there's
with the Gemara.
It's difference between an active act to the person and doing something passively that enables the person to die, as opposed to taking the pillow and putting it over his face.
Would this come in some way under the category of human beings playing God?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
It's that the time of Misa should be something that the Rabbanishalim decides and not human beings.
Right. You wonder about that. Someone actually, just last night, someone shared with me that he had the following experience 25 years ago, and he never really came to terms with it. This is what he said. He said he had a patient who was dying, by all accounts. It was a strange situation. The family had certain dysfunctions. Just a few days prior, the mother, who was quite elderly, had been had been admitted to the ICU, and it was looking very bad, and he knew that she had a very short amount of time to live, and it got to a point where she was very, very close to passing away. And he knew that she had a pacemaker, and somehow he could extend her life for a short period of time. So I don't know exactly what the medical technology is, maybe something to me, but that's what he explained to me. And he said that right around the time, just a few minutes before she was supposed to pass, the daughter came in. Fortunately, whatever dysfunction, the daughter was drunk. I mean, this is like, it's hard to imagine. I took a, sort of a double take. I said, was it just that something had happened completely unexpected? He said, no, the mother had been admitted a few days prior. And I was having a hard time. But wow. You have, I mean... Yeah, there's also everything, right? Anything and everything. It's just, he's the doctor. He's just seeing what there is and dealing with it as it comes. So he said that he knew that he could give her a couple minutes to kind of settle down, and that he could potentially, the woman was about to pass, but he could potentially extend her life by a few minutes, long enough that he knew he'd be able to give the daughter some meaningful time with her mother.
Ooh.
And then she would pass either way. And he said that he made a decision to extend her life. Made a decision, extended her life by a few minutes, and indeed the daughter, sober enough, whatever it looked like, was able to spend time with her mother, whatever closure. And then when he knew it was a minute or two, he asked her to step out and said, you know, this is a scenario, and took proper care, and then, you know, whatever number of minutes later, called her back in. All that. And this reminds me of exactly the story, because I said, from your medical perspective, did you cause the mother additional pain? Or basically, he extended her life, not for her own sake, as it were, but so the daughter could feel more closure. Now, maybe you could say if the mother knew that her daughter would have closure, but she was no longer conscious, she would never know that. If there was no possibility, but that, in a way, is that a way of caring for the mother in a larger, more holistic sense of the term.
More a matter of caring for the daughter.
Well, that's what I was saying. Right, exactly. Said, but is it appropriate for me to extend someone's life or to change the amount of time that someone's going to live, not for the patient, him or herself, but for a kin, family member? He said, I felt like I was playing God.
Yeah. But he was doing a kindness.
Right. So on the flip side of that, you could say that enabling a person who's close to death to hurry up the process is also doing a kindness, especially if they are in pain or, you know, if you know that, wow, they're really suffering.
Right.
Or to use an incredibly abused expression, if they no longer have a quality of life, whatever that may mean.
Right. Yeah. Or do we distinguish, in fact, between shortening a life and extending a life, and say if life is of inestimable value, then at minimum we cannot take away from that life, leaving aside the palliative questions for a moment, but to actively at least remove life would be murder, but to extend life is either neutral or can be considered to be an extension of that which is of inestimable value, all things being equal. Now, by that argument, of course, then you would say, well, even if there's no kindness to the daughter, we should just extend life indefinitely, and that also we might be uncomfortable saying. And then there are utilitarian calculations that interfere in the real world, like hospital beds, insurance companies, and all these things we'd rather not think about, but are very much a very realistic part of all, everything we're talking about. But yeah, this question of playing God is exactly what it reminded me of. I told him I did not think he did anything wrong. I said, I'm not one to decide whether or not you played God, but I said, I completely understand why you were uncomfortable with the scenario. I said, in my armchair reaction is that if you did not cause additional suffering, that this is an act of kindness ultimately, and therefore I don't think you have anything to clap al chid for. But it was striking to me that 25 years later...
Oh, yeah, you never forget something like that.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's just... He's,
what
right?
were the other responses among the other people?
It's a private conversation.
Oh.
No, it wasn't this top secret, but it was after the share. So, yeah.
So I'm curious about one thing.
Yeah.
It says, Ve'en ha'nishamai cholal etzit.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? That the nishama could not leave? There's something interesting in the language to me. And then the notion that, I'm trying to think of a way to say it that isn't, too demeaning. That you know, there's this, urban myth that the pillow is involved somehow.
Sure.
But there's a knowledge that this may or may not be folklore.
And I think he's aware of that.
I think the way his tone is in presenting this
is that
they have this thing when it says Yesh Omri,
Right.
In other words, he said, the change in language that I see, Ve'ena Nishma Yechola, let's say it is a statement, She Omrim Ki Yesh B'mitanot, there are those who think over
or
there
urban
in the
myth.
Village.
That's right. That's right.
Socioeconomic. That the pillow is
I don't know if he means it socioeconomically, but I think he means it intellectually in his milieu. I think that's right.
So there's the question: is like, can you do? Is somebody going to prohibit something that? I feel like somehow that's involved in how you hold this.
Right.
It's not like people are going to think all kinds of things. Do you let them go ahead and do whatever will bring, if it's not really impacting?
That's right. Yeah, no, and I think you're right. It's interesting because often we see these, what we assume are incorrect medical assumptions, which you find in rabbinic literature. And sometimes we say, well, then what do we do with this? How do we handle this matter of practical halacha? But you don't see this skepticism from a rabbinic authority about a contemporary practice. You see that nowadays, but you don't see that, I think, in so many texts. So I think it's actually fascinating. It's for the rabbi to be the one saying, you know what, I'm not really so sure about this one.
This feels a little hoodoo.
And and you're absolutely right.
There's a little bit of magical thinking going on here. So
yeah,
well, except that a lot of medical conditions require somebody to be on race,
that's a really good point.
Yeah. So they might not have known the medical condition of the elevation point, but they associated it with feather pillow.
So you're saying that they create the theory about the bird's feathers when we're talking about, pulmonary involvement at a bed race.
Right.
Oh, well, that's fascinating.
Right. I don't assume that this is actually medically true, but I think they were basing these on sort of, intelligent assessments based on what they could observe. I'm not saying it's correct. I'm just saying. You'd expect that there are many myths that are surrounding a topic like this. I mean, this is exactly where you'd anticipate finding things like that. Beginning of life, end of life, key life cycle moments. This is where you find those sorts of things sprouting up in particular. We'll see more. The keys. You want to hear the keys? We'll talk about keys. Keys next to the bed.
Haven't heard that one.
I was thinking the line in the sand was this notion of that there's it is or it, that it's something that isn't not the scientific proven piece, but that there's, because it's an unknown thing and it's a custom or it's folklore, that it doesn't fall under an active act of doing something that is guaranteed to bring about a quicker demise in a way that they would feel rabbinically was connected to something solid groundwork. Does that make sense? Is that too subtle?
I don't think it's too subtle. I just don't think it's what he's driving at. I think what he's driving at is what Paya was saying.
Got it.
I think that's here, but I don't think that they're interconnected analytically in terms of the halachic piece.
Okay.
Of it. That's my understanding.
Okay. That's what I was just reading and getting into trying to figure out if there was a...
I understand exactly what you're saying. I think that that's not what he's driving at, but I understand why you would see that here, and I think it is here. I just don't know if they're intertwined in quite that way.
Yeah.
This becomes a basis for the larger distinction, clearly, between active and passive, or omission versus commission, whatever language we want to use. But I think what it also demonstrates is that line can sometimes be rather blurry. Right? I mean, I can understand conceptually that there's a distinction between active and passive. Right? And I think you can say... Right? I mean, to go back to the examples from last week, so those who recall, so you have the scenario of... Let's take this, that's what I think you can call, for those who were here, at least 1B. So in other words, this is a scenario. You have the trolley car hurtling down, and you see that it's going to hit 5 people, and you can push the overweight individual, right? We call the fat man, over the bridge, right? Down and to kill, and to...
To stop.
Right, to stop the trolley car. You'll kill that one individual, but you'll save the 5. Right? So that's the scenario. Right? So... in that case, I think it's pretty clear cut that if you choose not to push the individual, that's an act of omission. And if you push the individual, that's an act of commission. One is passive, one is active. That's rather clear. But I think what this case exemplifies is that in the real world, these things are often quite murky. So if a person is on one's deathbed and you remove a pillow, and let's say whatever medical assumptions stand behind that, are you actively killing them or are you removing an impediment to death?
I think that's exactly the question, but I think it's also important to, at least, you know, from my perspective, to be clear at what this is not a discussion of. It's not a discussion of somebody who is suffering and you can do something that will relieve their suffering but may shorten their lives. I think that's a whole different issue, and that's not what this is about.
Right. But it might be highly relevant to that scenario, clearly, if I think that that is murder, halachically speaking, then even if my intention is to reduce pain, it becomes very complicated from a halachic perspective. If at the end of the day, with the goal of reducing suffering, which is a noble goal, I murder someone, halachically speaking, it's a harsh way of putting it, but that's the view. If I maintain, for example, that brain death is not death, then it's comparable. It's different. I'm not equating, but it's roughly comparable or analogous to that question. I'm killing someone in order to save another life, but it's still murder.
But
it's not the same case,
medical subtlety is that it's never as black and white as that. It's that it is possible that you may shorten their lives. It's possible, for example, their blood pressure may drop, but it may not. You know, it's not as clear cut that you are. It's rarely clear cut that you're going to do this act and it will definitely shorten their lives.
What about the ventilator? What about turning off the machine?
Oh, that's a different issue. That's a different issue.
It's closely related to this, isn't it?
No. I'm talking. Usually, if you have somebody at that point, the people who are suffering more are their family. I'm talking more about, you know, pain relief. You know, do you give that injection of morphine or something like
that's
that?
That's right. So, yeah.
That's a different issue.
And there what we have, we're going to come to what we call the doctrine of double effect.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, if my intention is to relieve pain,
yeah,
and a secondary effect is that a person dies earlier.
A person may die earlier.
Right? Or we'll talk about
that,
right?
It's usually more subtle.
Right?
What's the other sense?
There is a philosophical, commonly held, although disputed, philosophically position out there in the general ethical literature that is permissible. That, in other words, there's a distinction between an act of direct murder and death as a secondary implication or outgrowth of my primary intention, my primary action. And there is a significant halachic literature that we're going to have to look at least a piece of, whether or not, according to halacha, do we accept the doctrine of double effect? Because it goes to questions of omission, commission, but it goes to another piece, which is intentionality. And had this right, that was what we said last week. We said, well, you have this sort of the intrinsic school, and you have the extrinsic school, and then what's the role of intention in all of this? And that's where that comes
up.
In halacha, or in general, well, in halacha, we have, I'll say the background quickly, and we'll come back to it in a little bit
more. Unless you don't want to...
No, I don't mind saying now, the order is not so important, but we will circle back and see a little bit more on it. The argument goes as follows. There's a general halachic category that intentionality may be essential to defining my act. So, for example, there's a category, let's say the example of the laws of Shabbat, of something that we call idavar she'ino mitgavein, something that's unintended. That's exactly the halachic category that is then carried over to medical ethics. It's fascinating to see how this works. So the case when it comes to the laws of Shabbat is that if I, for example, am dragging a bench, as a class, I know that one of the 39 melachot, one of the 39 prohibited categories in Shabbat is to dig a ditch, to plow, and by extension, to dig a ditch. So let's say I have a very muddy backyard, and anyone who comes to the Sinensky home, I will show you a case in point, and you are to go into my backyard and start dragging a bench through, it will very quickly become something that looks like my children were having a play date outside. And it becomes dangerous. People start falling in. All sorts of things can happen when you dig ditches in our backyard. Not the first time we've seen that. So when it's Shabbat, let's say, and you want to drag that bench across a muddy backyard. And one scenario, let's say, is where there's a significant possibility, but not certainty, that you will, in doing so, cause a ditch, ultimately, to be dug. However deep that is and what exactly that looks like, but halachically it rises to the level where you have dug a ditch on Shabbat, and that's a violation of vanan lacho. So the halachic principle there is that there's some machloket about it, but we assume it's actually permissible. That's not your primary intention. It's called idavar she'inu mitkaven, something that is unintended. Something that is unintended. Now, to come to Paya's point, there's another a variation on this, in which you have a idavar she'inu mitkaven, something that was unintended. In other words, my primary purpose, in other words, even you could even say the essential definition of my halachic act is, if you say conceptually, what am I doing? I am dragging a bench. I'm not digging a ditch, I'm dragging a bench. There's a secondary consequence of my action, which is that there is a ditch that is dug, but that's not my action. My action is dragging a bench. Now, let's say, in one scenario, the first scenario we gave, it possibly was going to cause the ditch to be dug. We said that's halachically permissible. But what about a case in which we know in advance that it is 100%, that it is certain, or all but certain, that it will, the effect of my dragging the bench will be the digging of a ditch. That's called the davar she'inu mitkaven, which is something unintended, but that's called, we call it a psik reshe. Psik reshe is a little gory, you'll forgive me. Psik reshe literally means to cut off a head, and this is going to sound shocking in Talmudic times. Children would play with, just putting it out there, would actually play with heads. That was what they used for balls. It sounds
heads?
Horrifying. This is not just Jews, this is common practice. The world has changed a lot.
Wait, animal heads or human heads?
Rooster heads.
Oh.
To be specific.
Okay,
I'm not joking. So the first category is davar she'inu mitkaven, that means something that is unintended. And the second one is psik reshe, which literally means cutting off. Psik is Aramaic for cutting off, lafsik. Reshe means harosh shelo, its head. So this is, it's metaphorical, or it's an analogical, but the point is, it's something, if you cut off the animal's head, what I'm doing is I'm creating a ball, or, right, yeah, something, or a plaything. But it is 100% certain that I will have killed the animal,
yes,
by engaging in this activity. So it's a little bit of a gory metaphor, but the point is that, similarly, if you're dragging the bench, it most definitely will happen that there will be a ditch in scenario number two, right, where it's just obvious. That's asur. So what that means is, to come to the morphine case, so if we then, that's right, so then if the dosage would be at the point that the person will definitely die sooner, or definitely die, then that would be a problematic scenario potentially. But where it's a possibility that the person will die, then that would be halachically have much more legs on which to stand, as it were. So that's exactly where we're going to go.
Streets near me, people have lights that if you just walk by, the light goes on.
Sure, yeah,
so the
sensor light question.
Sure. To happen, I didn't know.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, I'm walking by and the thing, it's on Shabbat.
Sure.
And the thing goes on.
That's right.
So I asked somebody about that, and I was told, well, now that you know,
you can't do it.
Not to do
walk
it.
Walk on the other side.
But yeah, yeah.
You didn't
Which
know,
is
you,
why
you
a lot of people won't put up motion detector lights in their front doors.
Right.
Because they're forcing people to come in.
That's right. Yeah,
so practical point for people who are thinking of this. What we did with our spotlights, instead of putting up motion detectors, we put up
timers.
Dusk dawn sensors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they automatically go on dusk and off at dawn.
That's it.
No motion detectors.
No motion detectors.
To install it from the get-go. Very smart.
But I'm just mentioning because
of the absolutely.
Range of activities.
And it raises another question, which is, you know, it's not clear always in that scenario and others, there's so many other instances of this, that this is beneficial for you. That's right. So there's a, because there's an yet another distinction. This is, you know, we're learning Gemara here, so there has to be at least 14. So we're only at number 3, so we've got a while to go. The right, so you have, okay, what happens if it's davar she'eino mitkaven, if it's unintended, bifsik reshe, i.e. there will be a definite result, such as turning on the sensor light. Right. Meaning, if the light was on, if the sensor is on and I walk past, 100 out of, unless it's broken.
Right.
If it's working properly, 100 out of 100 times it will turn on. But let's just say, I don't need the illumination. I don't benefit from it. Right. So it's lo nichale. It doesn't benefit you. And what constitutes benefit anyway? What if, yeah, I benefit once it happened, but I don't really care for it particularly, and so on and so forth. What if I don't get any benefit, but I also don't lose anything? What's that? So there are all sorts of nichale, lo nichale, right? Lo ichbatle, which is an in-between category. I could care less one way or the other. So it gets complicated, and then how does that play in? To the, and then how do you define nichale here? Because here it's the doctor is the one performing the act. It's not for myself. It's really for the patient. So it's not a benefit for me directly, it's really a benefit for the patient. So,
but what are the implications, if I may ask, because I think it's related, that I think it's an agarata about the servant of a well-known chacham who's dying, clearly dying. And
source 7.
Oh, it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I just didn't get
no, you're right. So yeah, yeah, everything you're mentioning.
She throws the pot and
yeah,
everybody says
there.
It's okay.
We're going there. Okay, so we're gonna look at that in moments. Okay, okay, so let's exactly move ahead. So the Shul Digiborim is an absolutely foundational text because he gives us a distinction between omission and commission. Seems to subscribe to that ethical theory where really it's not just about the consequences, but there really is. And I think in general, halakha inclines toward a middle position where consequences matter, but that first and foremost you have to ask about the inherent morality of the act, I would say. I would say halakha probably has a two-tiered system, but is not purely utilitarian. That would be my strong suggestion. But the Shulchan Aruch gives us parameters and speaks to the sort of the fundamental ambiguities. Okay, but the omission-commission distinction, what does that look like in the real world? And that's where it starts to become very murky. And I think a lot of our contemporary questions center around exactly that question. So what exactly is omission and commission? And what if, is there a distinction between, is it omission not to give them the most basic nutrients and fundamentals of life? What exactly, you know, does that look like? So we're going to have to examine that as we go. Good. In sources 5 and 6, I'm not going to focus these on very much, but they did come up and they're pertinent to the question of the value of life. So just very quickly, you know, for example, we said, well, maybe life is of inestimable value, but maybe it's also a means toward an end of using a life towards something that's elevated, serving God, etc. Well, the Gemara, when it talks about the halakha requirement to violate Shabbat to save a life, actually formulates it in seemingly contradictory ways around exactly this question. So the Gemara states a view, it's already on the next side, where the Gemara says that at the beginning of the, on the top line of the next page in source 5, in the middle of source 5, Amrat Torah, one explanation of the obligation to save a life is Chalel of Shabbat Acha Kedish Yishmor Shabbatot Harbeh, violate one Shabbat so that this individual may observe more. Sounds like the value of the chayt, right, of the life is more consequential, as it were, instrumental. But then the Gemara turns around and says that no, Amrei Yehuda, Amrei Shmuel, and the Gemara previously cited a whole slew of possible sources. It says they're all wrong, including the last one. Amrei Yehuda, Amrei Shmuel says, well, if I was in the Beit Midrash while you guys were having this conversation, if you actually invited me to the pre-meeting, as it were, says I would have preferred the following source. And he says, v'chay bohem, v'lo she'emut bohem, live, not die by the mitzvah. Well, that's a much broader, maybe a more intrinsic kind of approach. So there are tensions here in terms of, you know, and is this just a nice piece in the Gemara? You know, many Shabbatot. Okay, do we really start making that calculation? Really? That doesn't sound like what we do. We save a life, right? I mean, I don't mean all circumstances, but in the palliative care questions, but...
I have a cute anecdote.
You know,
people were walking to Shul and saw the Gabbai driving away on Shabbat morning. And so immediately they said, oh, his wife is having her baby today.
Okay. There you have it. Yeah, okay. We should all be so charitable. It's a beautiful story. And we're still aspiring toward that as a Jewish community, but it's a good model. Okay, then the next source is what we mentioned earlier, which is that we save life and violate any avir on the Torah with the exception of the big three. So again, that tension of, well, v'chay bohem, live, But there are things. There's illicit relations, and there's murder, and there's idolatry, which seem to supersede even that. So there are these larger tensions that I think there is in life is of intrinsic value, not merely extrinsic value. And yet, just because you have an intrinsic value doesn't mean it is the ultimate or the only thing that counts. And so there are these tensions. And I still think we need to work on kind of, you know, what is the halachic definition? I'm working on it, but I'm still not there. So I'm open to your suggestions. Okay, let's come now to the story that Emily has mentioned, because this is going to be important for all sorts of scenarios and raises some hard questions. So Gemara tells the following story, bottom of page, source 7. Hahu yoma denoch nafshei de Rebbe. It's told the story that on the day that Rebbe died, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, this is the editor, the great editor, compiler of the Mishnah.
Not just anybody.
Right? That's right. And the Gemara actually has very specific things to say about the day that Rebbe died. The Gemara says the day that Rebbe died, that there was no longer greatness and scholarship in the same place as we had ever had. Wow. He was considered to be a real, not just a great leader, but almost like a monarch. I don't mean in terms of his power, but in terms of the regality, in terms of the his bearing and the way that people... Right, but I mean what they call soft power, not hard power. In other words, not titular, but rather in terms of just the sway that he had with the community. The reverence with which he was held. So, Ahu Yom Denach Nafshi, the Rebbe, on the day that Rebbe ultimately died. This is, you'll see quickly, story that precedes his actual moment of death, but it's the day when ultimately he passed. Gazru Rabbanan Tanisas. The rabbis were still praying for him to survive, and they declared a fast. Uva'u Rachme, and they beseeched God for mercy, the Amre, and they said, that Kol Man De Amar Noch Nafshi, the Rebbe. Anyone who says that Rebbe should die, yidaker becharev, should be stabbed with a sword.
Yeah. Should die or has died.
Died already.
What? Anyone who incorrectly circulates rumors that he has died shall be stabbed with a sword. Now, this is... Yeah, sorry, I misspoke. This is an interesting...
In
I'm reading... What?
We were reading it in English.
Okay. All right, it's an argument for translation. I'll tell to tell Joel Hecker. Okay. Anyhow, so... it's interesting to try to imagine, and we can only imagine what exactly was happening, was transpiring. Were there rumors of his death that were circulating, and so they went to squash that? And if people had already acknowledged or assumed that he had passed away, you're going to lose the prayers of the community, and incorrect rumors will start circulating. Don't give up hope, and that sort of thing. It's the famous story that when Mark Twain read his obituary in the local newspaper, said that the reports of my death had been greatly exaggerated. So he must have known Gemara. This is my takeaway from this. Anyhow, so this is apparently something along these lines. And they're still davening for him. But then the Gemara, there's a term. So Slika Amte de Rebbe Leigra, the maidservant Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, went up to the roof. Amra, and she said, there is a tug of war, as it were. A very serious, right? Very serious one. Elyonim mevakshimes Rebbe. The heavens are demanding Rebbe. They're requesting his presence. Atachtonim mevakshimes Rebbe. And so she prays that Yehi Ratzo may be the will of the divine. Sheachufu tachtonim et elyonim. That this world defeat the upper world. In other words, he should survive. This is a traditional prayer that he should continue to live. But then the story takes a turn, as you're already seeing in the English. Once she saw on a number of occasions, the Isle of Esakise, that he went to the restroom, Chalat's tefillin, he removed his tefillin, Manachluhu, and he put them back on and in and out, in and out. In other words, he's experiencing some sort of terrible digestive, you know, condition, and he's suffering tremendously. So the Gemara says that become a star, and he's suffering. So Amra, she said, the Yehi Ratzon Sheachufu Elyonim Et Hatachtonim. And this is remarkable.
Wow.
She prays.
Not allowed to do that.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Well, now.
And she's a maidservant.
Well, yeah, that's the best part.
Okay, right. By the way, I'll say this now before we even finish. Rav Soloveitchik has a stunning lecture. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's very thought-provoking. I don't have the original transcript, but it was written up. It was summarized by one of his students in a book entitled Reflections of the Rav. And it is all about how, if you take a look at the Gemara, in countless passages, the Gemara relies on the saying of a servant, of a maidservant, of just a yena, you know, etc. And the rabbis say we can prove that this is right because, after all, this is what the commoners say.
Uh-huh.
It's very, very striking. Or this is what an individual that you might have otherwise perceived as being lower class said. This is their wisdom, mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because contemporaneously, in let's say in Roman circles at the same time, there was a lot of sort of a dismissiveness about lower classes, and there's a very clear caste system. There have been some who suggest that this is part of sort of a larger rabbinic, not destruction, I would say, but a sort of a discomfiture with some of the castes that had been in place at that time in that culture. But this is an interesting example. This, she's held up as heroic. There's nothing in this Gemara to indicate that she's anything but not just correct, but viewed as authoritative in terms of her opinion in this case. I mean, this is the right thing to do. It's very striking. So, right? Can you do this? Can you do this? The Gemara's not done. V'loha v'shapke rabban milubayi rachame. They were still praying, and they were saying, "Stop circulating these rumors." And she's saying that, "I hope he passes." I mean, this is right. You almost see like the split picture. You see, right? In other words, they continue to daven while she's davening that he passed away. Of course, she has information that they don't have. Initially, she was also praying the same way, but she understood. She's with the patient, right? There's something deeply humanistic about this as well, which is quite profound. Okay, so she's reading the suffering.
And she's not praying for death. She's praying that...
Yeah, mercy.
Go ahead.
That the heavens above will prevail over our...
Go ahead.
Mortal.
Very, very lovely and not chutzpah. You know, it's not like saying that I'm making this judgment. It's saying that... Mm-hmm. You know, we know what the right thing is, and we sometimes fight that because we're humans and mm-hmm. we love not to lose.
I agree. I love her language.
You know, the language is so respectful.
That's right. Because she could have just as easily said, "Hiratzon sheyamut mehira v'al yitzna'er harveh," even
if she said
that.
Which is what people say, you know? I mean... sometimes.
We'll talk about it.
People in the world. I'm not saying it's.
There's an extensive halachic literature about this also. You know. I'll start sharing with you in a moment. It's.
But instead, she's turning it around to be that it should prevail over our mortal prayers of.
Love it. Very nice. Yeah, so just to finish the story, so the rabbis were not quiet. So as you see, she took a jug, she tossed it, she threw it, hurled it from the roof to the ground. So they stopped praying because they were just distracted for a moment, right? And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi passed. This is shades of there's a Gemara about David HaMelech, as Yerushalmi. That David HaMelech was not dying, but he was supposed to pass on a Shavuot. According to traditional story, he was learning, and it was only when there was a disruption. When the Yetzer Hara tried to, Macha Mavet wanted to take his life and couldn't get him to stop learning. He couldn't pass, as it were, right? So it's better than even feathers. And so... and the Yetzer Hara had to create some distraction, so cause some great sonic boom type sound, and then he was able to pass away, as it were. That's how the story goes. A similar kind of thing. Yeah, so this is,
except in that case it was the Yetzer Hara. It was...
Well, Malach HaMavis, I misspoke, sorry.
Oh,
Malach HaMavis.
Okay.
In other words, not necessarily...
Right,
No, that's right. And remember, the rabbinic tradition is that David HaMelech had 70 years.
Right,
there's sort of this background to it that sort of, that there was some story that maybe he even should have lived. She should have died in childbirth, according to the rabbinic tradition. And whatever this means, he borrows 70 years from Adam, and Adam lives 930, and he lives 70. Again, whatever this means, but the point is, it wasn't... Malach HaMavis was his time had come, right? This is...
It's
those are... That's it. Time to come, wasn't it?